with two flavors. So if you like, with only up and down corks. And if you recall, the QCD Lagrangian at high energies has the following form. And as far as the, oh, sorry, there should be a covariant derivative. And if you recall, the QCD gauge coupling, right, as alpha s, as a function of some scale mu, going to high energies, it falls off and it goes to zero. But going to low energies, it blows up. And when it goes up, when it blows up, clearly we can't apply perturbation theory anymore. Our usual Feynman diagram expansions of quantum field theories totally break down. Those aren't trustworthy. And we have to think of something else. So what I want to talk about today is that something else. And that something else is going to be to try to figure out how to write down an EFT that's valid in this low energy range. So over here, you know you have a good theory that's reasonably perturbative as long as you're away from lambda QCD with quarks and gluons. And we wanted to try to find a way to match this to some kind of effective field theory that's valid down here. So observationally, we actually know what kind of fields should be in that EFT. There are baryons, and there are mesons, and everything is color neutral. We're going to focus on the mesons, and the mesons will come out in kind of a nice way. And the thing we're going to use to make that happen is the observation that this lambda QCD is roughly 200 MeV. And we're going to look at, so we're going to focus on only up and down quarks. And we're going to use the fact that mu is roughly 2.5 MeV. MD is roughly 5.3 MeV. And these are both much, much less than lambda QCD. So we're going to initially ignore these masses and then come back and put them into small perturbations. So I guess.
Does the value of lambda QCD depend on the number of perturbations we keep?
Yes. So here I'm just going to keep it fixed. But it also depends on how you match the high energy theory. So what you usually do is you extract alpha strong at some pretty high scale, usually pretty close to the Z mass, and then you run it down. And the way you run it down depends on how many flavors there are. So technically, the value you get physically will depend on that extrapolation, which depends on the number of flavors. For now, I'm just going to keep it at this fixed value. And I'll come back and worry about the strange quark, which is a mass on the order of lambda QCD later on, still a little bit less. So at this point, we don't have perturbation theory. And perturbation theory is our standard tool. So we're going to have to be a little bit creative. And the little bit creative thing is to try to figure out how many degrees of freedom you have in low energy effective theory, and try to figure out what their symmetries are, and then write down the most general Lagrangian consistent with those degrees of freedom and that set of symmetries, and then use data or some kind of non-perturbative technique like lattice QCD to match up to the theory of quarks and gluons. So we have this. And then one other important piece that's going to come in is the fact that there is something called a quark condensate. And that quark condensate can be expressed by looking at the quark anti-quark bilinear operator. So this thing is a color singlet. It's an anti-fundamental, and the color indices are contracted, and there's some flavor structure. And you can show that, or it turns out that this is just delta ij lambda QCD cubed. So the strong dynamics effectively gives you a vacuum expectation value for this composite operator. Now, you don't get non-zero vacuum expectation values for individual quarks. because they carry Lorentz index, and that would spontaneously break Lorentz, which we know isn't the case. But this is consistent with Lorentz, and it turns out that this is what you get by matching two observations. So we can go back to our Lagrangian, and in the limit when these masses are zero, so for now let's set the masses to zero, you can show, or it's easy to see, that there is a set of global symmetries. So I'm going to rewrite the Lagrangian in a slightly suggestive form. Like so, where QL is made up of a doublet made of the up left and down left. So this is familiar for a second. And Q right is what I get by combining U right and down right. Yes?
So when we ignore the quark masses, are we making certain assumptions of the origin of those masses?
No. So at this point, we're just using the fact that they're numerically small. So since they're numerically small, and the main part of the dynamics will be controlled by lambda QCD, the corrections from the quarks will be relatively suppressed by factors of quark mass over lambda QCD. So we can come back and treat those as small perturbations later on. So if you like, this theory is our harmonic oscillator, and we're going to come back later on and put in our perturbations, our n-harmonic terms. Okay, so I haven't done anything special. I've just rewritten this Lagrangian in a suggestive way. I've used the fact that, except for the mass term, the kinetic part of the quark of fermion field separates into separate left and right pieces. And I've combined the up and down parts into these doublets. So at this point, this is just a rewriting. But what you can show, and this is easy to see in this form, is that this is invariant under a set of transformations. So the first set of transformation is QL goes to L QL, QR goes to QR. The second is QL goes to QL, QR goes to let me just see how I want to write this. RQR. And for now, I'll assume that L is an SU2 matrix. We're going to call this SU2L. And R is also an SU2 matrix, and it's also an SU2R. It's also in an SU2, which we'll call SU2R. So for now, we're just looking at pure QCD. We're ignoring any kind of weak interactions. So at this point, these are just global symmetries. And then there are two other apparent symmetries. One is QL goes to e to the I alpha V, QL, and QR goes to e to the I alpha V, QR. And we call this U1V. And there's one other symmetry that I'll write down. QL and QR goes to e to the I alpha QL, e to the minus alpha I. And then this is also a symmetry. So this and this is equivalent to saying that I do a refacing of this independently of a refacing of that. But I'm going to combine them into two slightly different linear combinations where I rephase them together and I rephase them oppositely. So this is just, if you like, a different basis for the rephasing. And this is called U1A. So now, in this QCD theory, these are symmetries of this classical Lagrangian. And it turns out that this symmetry, and this symmetry are also symmetries at the quantum level. So quantum effects don't change the fact that these are symmetries. It turns out the quantum effects, in a slightly subtle way, does wreck this symmetry. So for now, we're not going to worry about this particular symmetry. We're going to concentrate on these three symmetries. So these are the three good symmetries at the quantum level that the theory realizes. So these are our good symmetries. But if we go back and look at this operator is not invariant under these SU2 left and SU2 right transformations. Yes. Oh, sorry. Yeah. So yeah, and these, yeah, you're right. Okay, I'll just write this. And these are all QCD covariant derivatives. And as far and then all this all these things for now are just global transformations, so they just breeze right through the covariant derivatives. And the covariant derivative here is just the QCD part. Okay. So looking at these transformations and applying them to the condensate, we see that the condensate spontaneously breaks SU2 left and SU2 right. And that if I make one of these transformations on these things, the form of my expectation value changes. Instead of having a delta ij, I get something that looks like an LR dagger. So the upshot of this is that we have the set of global symmetries, but these global symmetries, or some fraction of them, are spontaneously broken by this condensate. So this is somewhat analogous to what happens in, let's say, a Higgs model, where your underlying theory is invariant under a set of transformations, but the vacuum expectation value is not. You have to choose a specific vacuum. This is a similar idea. You have to choose a specific vacuum, and the specific vacuum is not invariant under some set of these transformations. Now, if I look at the U1V part, the U1V part does happen to be invariant under here, because the phase of one side cancels off the phase of the other. And in fact, there's also a subgroup of this left and right part that leaves this invariant. And we'll call it SU2V. And this subgroup corresponds to the transformations such that L is equal to R. So if I look at the condensate, this condensate transforms into something that looks like L R dagger times what I had initially. Now I see that if I have left L equals R for the subgroup of SU2 left cross SU2 right, this does leave the condensate invariant. And with a bit of fiddling, you can show that this is in fact the maximal subgroup. And if you like the form of an L transformation, it's just a standard exponential of the generator. In this case, the generator acting on the doublets is sigma matrix over 2. This is the fundamental representation of SU2. And this full group has independent alpha A left and alpha A right. And if you like, the subgroup corresponds to the subgroup generated such that you have alpha A left equal to alpha A right, which in other words just means that left is equal to right. OK, so if I now count what I have, SU2 left and SU2 right, they're SU2s. And any SUN has n squared minus 1 generators, so 3. So here I have 3 generators. And here I have 3 generators. Again, it's obvious sigma over 2. But this V subgroup also has 3 generators. And the upshot of this is that the quark condensate if you like, quote unquote, breaks through generators in the sense that I can assemble my generators into this subgroup and then some some generators for the rest of the space. And of the six initial ones, I have three left over. So there are three quote unquote broken generators. And the upshot of this, in the usual counting, is that this implies three NGBs. An NGB is a Nambu Goldstone boson. And you guys have seen Goldstones before. Okay. So this is a case of spontaneously breaking a global symmetry and getting Nambu Goldstone bosons, so-called NGBs. But in a way that's maybe slightly different from probably the Higgs mechanism or Higgs-like mechanism you've seen before. But the upshot of this is this spontaneous breaking tells us that we expect to have three NGBs. And generically, when you spontaneously break a symmetry, what happens is you get the massless Nambu Goldstone bosons plus everything else in your theory, generally, not always, but generally, gets masses on the order of the breaking scale. So our naive expectation, and this is what we're going to run with, is that the low energy degrees of freedom are going to correspond to these massless Nambu Goldstone bosons. So by low energy, I mean an energy is well below lambda QCD. And the other stuff should typically get masses on the order of lambda QCD itself. And we're going to ignore that. So our strategy is going to be to concentrate on these light Nambu Goldstone boson degrees of freedom and try to write down an effective field theory for them in such a way that is consistent with the symmetries of the theory. And what I mean by consistent with the symmetries of the theory is that here we're spontaneously breaking a symmetry. And it turns out that when you spontaneously break a symmetry, you can still write a Lagrangian that's invariant under that symmetry, but with possibly nonlinear transformation rules for the fields. So that's going to be our goal. So, yes?
So could you repeat, what's the scale that we expect the Nambu Goldstone boson to be at?
Oh, well, so at this point, these are exact Nambu Goldstone bosons, so they'll be massless. So we want to write down a theory that's valid way, way below lambda QCD. So for way, way below lambda QCD, we're going to be stuck with the massless particles. But the other stuff in the theory should be near lambda QCD, so we're going to ignore that and just focus on this part of the theory. So again, we're kind of flying by the seats of our pants right now because this is strong coupling, and we don't really have usual control over the field theory of strong coupling, but at least we can do something in terms of these Nambu Goldstone bosons. So we're going to write down an effective field theory for them. We're going to use the fact that because we've spontaneously broken the symmetry, we should still be able to write a Lagrangian that's invariant on the symmetry, but with possibly nonlinear transformation laws. And a third point, and it's good to keep in mind, is that when you do quantum field theories, you're used to having kind of like a nice set of fields, sort of there usually seems to be kind of like a special set of fields where everything works out. But in general, you should think of the fields in a quantum field theory as just some generalized variables in the sense of Lagrangian mechanics. So in Lagrangian mechanics, you have some generalized variables. And the whole point is that one of the reasons why Lagrangians are so powerful is that you can always change your variables to something that's easier. And the form of your equations of motion might look a little bit different, but a nice change of variables can make your life much easier. So we're going to try to make a choice of variables such that these transformation properties come out in sort of a nice way, and then use that to write down our NGB theory. So as far as doing this, again, let me remind you that there isn't a unique way to write down the Nambu Goldstone boson theory. But we're going to choose one that looks a bit complicated at first, but ends up being not so bad. And the way we're going to do this is we're going to use fields called sigma of x that are exponentials of 2i pi a of x over f. So these are our, I forgot something. So I'm going to write down, I'm going to try to use this as my field variable. So at this point, it looks a little bit funny. It's not coming. So I have three pi a's because I have three adjoint indices. So here, sigma a, here, recall that ta is just sigma a over 2. And here, f is some quantity of mass dimension 1. That for now I'm just putting in to make the argument of the exponential dimensionless. So this is going to be a scalar field, and because we're putting it into an exponential, the whole thing has to be dimensionless. So I'm just putting in something with mass dimension 1 to fix that up. And later on we can go back and try to match against data and try to figure out what this f thing actually is. So the whole point of this transformation thing is that it's going to turn out to have transformation properties that look a lot like the vacuum condensate. And what I mean by that is that we're going to assume that under these so-called flavor transformations, so I'm going to call this whole set of transformations G subflavor, the so-called flavor group. And I'm calling it a flavored group because these transformations are mixing the up and down flavors. G-flave transformations, I'm going to assume that this sigma transforms as a bifundamental. And the motivation for this is the fact that our vacuum condensate transforms in this way. The vacuum condensate goes to L something R dagger. So I can think of this in the limit where all my fields go to 0, and this reduces to the 2x2 unit matrix. This thing ends up looking like the transformation of the vacuum condensate. So these are my field variables. And in terms of the transformations, these L's just have the same form as before, and I can write my general left and right transformations. I can rewrite them as e to the I c a e to the I c v. So with a bit of fiddling and so-called Baker-Campbell-Hausdorffing, you can show that this is equivalent to these left and right transformations up here. But I've just separated the transformation into a piece that's explicitly vector, in the sense that if I only transform with CV and I set CA to 0, I get the vector subgroup. And what I'm calling CA is, if you like, the orthogonal part. So here there are still 6 generators, 3 CAAs and 3 CVAs, but now I've just rewritten the left and right in a slightly different way. And it's clear that this thing generates the SD2V subgroup. And based on this, it's also easy to see. Based on this, if I do a V transformation on this field, I get sigma x goes to v sigma v dagger. And you can show that this is equivalent to an exponential of 2i in the sense that if I take my exponential and I expand it out in terms of all the terms, I can insert VV dagger factors arbitrarily. Is this hard to see? So I'll write it bigger. It's an exponential of 2i V pi a ta v dagger over f. And this implies, this v pi a ta form implies that these pi a's transform in the adjoint representation of the spectral subgroup. So if you take the v and you expand it out infinitesimally, you'll see that in the infinitesimal form, it gives you pi a ta plus pi a CVA, CVB TB TA plus dot dot dot. And this form is equivalent to saying that pi a transforms under the adjoint. So this is equivalent to saying that pi a goes to pi prime a equals to delta AC minus F ABC CBV pi C. So this is just an adjoint transformation of the group. And actually, sorry, this FABC, because it's SU3, is actually just an epsilon ABC. And then plus higher order terms. But this is what you get for an infinitesimal transformation. Now, I can do the same thing with CV set to 0 and CA non-zero. And it turns out that under CA transformations, and this takes a little bit. So for A, I just have A dagger and so on. Pi goes to pi prime. And it turns out that you can show that pi prime is given by F CAA TA plus order CA squared. Oops. So this A part is a little bit funny in that obviously at zeroth order, I just got back my original field. But this first piece, This first piece is very strange based on what you've seen before. So from everything you've seen before, whenever you do a transformation on a field variable, it transforms linearly in the sense that the effect of the transformation, the infinitesimal change, can be expressed as some linear operation on the field itself. So if I think of the field, let's say, as a vector, my infinitesimal transformation is just some matrix acting on that vector. And it's linear in that sense. This is nonlinear. This is nonlinear in the sense that there's no pi field in here at all. And it turns out that this is a standard feature of Goldstone bosons. That when you have a Goldstone boson, there is a way to write the theory such that if you transform by the Broken symmetry, the Goldstone boson just transforms by a shift. And this gives you another way to understand why Goldstones are massless. Because if you have a field with a shift symmetry, that means that that field can't have a mass term. Because if I take a mass term, which is like m squared, let's say m squared phi squared, and I shift the field, obviously the mass term is not invariant. So another way to understand the masslessness of Goldstone bosons is that if you apply the Broken generator to them in an appropriate field basis, they go by a shift. And in this sense, we still have the symmetry in the theory, or we're still going to maintain the symmetry in the theory, but we're going to maintain it in a nonlinear way. Whereas what you usually do is keep the symmetries explicitly linear. OK, so we have these transformation properties. And we want to write down a Lagrangian that is invariant under the full SU2 left cross SU2 right cross U1 V. symmetry. The U1V part is fairly trivial on this because it's just a rephasing and everything passes through and it actually acts trivially. But we do want to maintain both left and right invariants where the vector subgroup is going to be a conserved symmetry with this adjoint linear transformation law, but where the axial subgroup, this orthogonal part, is going to lead to a shift symmetry. So our Lagrangian will still have a shift symmetry, but the fact that the Goldstone mode, which we're going to identify with the pies, has a shift symmetry means that we'll see that they're forced to come out massless. Yes?
A low energy theory that's spontaneously broken has a high energy symmetry, just realized non-linearity.
Yes.
So that's why we're considering SC2 cross SC2 in the in a non-massless.
Yeah. Well, so we're going to see. Well, okay. I should have mentioned it in before. Our pi A fields, we have three of them, so we have the right number of fields to give the Goldstones. And it's going to turn out that this choice of variables is a nice choice in that it makes explicit the remaining unbroken V and the spontaneously broken A, but our total Lagrangian will be invariant under the full underlying group. And it turns out that this is generally true, that when you spontaneously break a symmetry, you should still be able to write your theory in a way that's invariant under it, but with a nonlinear transformation law. Okay. So we have this shift symmetry. And let's try to write down terms of the Lagrangian. Okay. Now, I should also mention that, I think I have an example of it in my first set of notes talking about quantum field theory. I have a little bit where I talk about Goldstone bosons. And a nice toy model where you see a similar behavior is for U1. So suppose you spontaneously break a global U1 in a theory of a complex scalar. In the theory of a complex scalar, when you spontaneously break the U1, if you write your field so in the case of and this might be a good exercise, or go look it up in my notes. If I have a U1 that's spontaneously broken by a VAV phi equals V, then you can show that if you expand your field in this way, you still have a symmetry under which A goes to A plus F. And in this setup, you'll see that F corresponds roughly to V, up to factors of 2 or root 2. So I'm just mentioning this in passing. And what we're doing here is, even though it seems like I'm kind of pulling it out of my pocket, what's actually this form is just a generalization of what's done in this U1 case. So I would encourage you to go back and take a look at my first set of notes when I talk about Goldstones, and take a look at this. So this form is just a generalization of what's there before. And in this case, you'll also see that you have a shift symmetry for the A field. Anyway, getting back to this case, we want to write down a Lagrangian. And because we don't have control over the strongly coupled theory, because we don't have control over QCD, we're not able to just go through the strong coupling regime and figure out the EFT analytically. What we have to do instead, and this is often true of effective field theories, is essentially make guesses. So our first set of guesses, our first point is that we expect three NAMBU Goldstone modes, three NGB modes, so we're going to write down an effective field theory for them. And we're going to demand that our effective field theory is invariant under these left cross right transformations. And with those fields and this choice of parameterization of the variables and in the underlying symmetry, it's just a matter of going writing down all the terms you can that are consistent with the symmetries and trying to get out some sensible theory, and then fixing the coefficients of that theory with data. So my Lagrangian has to be real. So I'm going to need some sigmas and sigma daggers, because I have complex stuff going on in there. At the very least, I need a kinetic term for sigma. And I also need invariants. So one thing I could write down that would be invariant is trace sigma dagger sigma. Unfortunately, if I just write this down, this thing is just one. And that means that I don't get any interesting dependence on the pies. The reason I have the trace, though, is that this thing, okay, even though it's trivial, it's also worth looking at how it transforms. This thing would go to R sigma dagger L dagger L sigma R under the transformation. And because L is unitary, L dagger L So L dagger L just gives me the identity matrix. And then because of the cyclicity of the trace, I can bring this guy out through here, and that gives me one, and I get back trace sigma dagger sigma. And then as far as the sigma dagger transformation law goes, I'm just using the fact that, recall that if I have AB dagger, this is B dagger, A dagger. OK, so I found a possible invariant term in my Lagrangian. Unfortunately, it is just trivial. But what I could do, and this is motivated by the fact that the first thing you always want when writing down a reasonable theory is a kinetic term, is take this but put in derivatives. So suppose we look at suppose we try to write down a Lagrangian term of the form, so n is just going to be some normalization. I'll come back and worry about the normalization in a second, of trace del mu sigma dagger del mu sigma. Now, this term is invariant under these left and right transformations for exactly the same reason as the first line. And I don't have to worry about the derivatives because I'm only making global transformations. But now if I take this and apply it, this del mu sigma and del mu sigma is no longer just the identity. And the reason it's no longer the identity is that the derivative doesn't just factorize to the exponential because I have these non-abelian generators. And I can write this out. And the way to write this out is to take the exponential forms here, expand them out, and then collect all the terms and write stuff in terms of the pies. So if I take this and I write things out, what I get is going to be n trace del mu expanding out making a mess of this. I'm going to have del mu 1 plus I 2i pi a ta over f plus dot 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 dagger times del mu 1 plus 2i pi a ta over f plus dot, dot, dot. So I'm just taking my exponentials and I'm expanding them out. And the leading term is going to be, well, obviously del mu hitting 1 just gives me 0. And del mu hitting this thing is going to be del mu pi a with the ta. And I can also use the fact that trace ta tb for the fundamental is just 1 half delta ab. To rewrite this as n times 4 over f squared times 1 half sum on a del mu pi a squared plus dot, dot, dot. So in general, I'm going to get an infinite number of terms. But the leading term in the expansion is going to be just this thing that looks like a perfectly nice kinetic term for pi a. But I need to get the normalization right. So this pi a is a real scalar. And if you recall the canonical normalization, the normalization you want for a real scalar is just 1/2 del phi squared. So that means that I need to choose my n to be f squared over 4 to cancel off that to give 1/2 del mu pi a squared. So what I get out of this for my Lagrangian term is that I get a nice normalization for n is equal to f squared over 4. So this is the leading non-trivial term I can write down in my effective Lagrangian, my so-called chiral Lagrangian. And first of all, when you expand out the exponential, you see that you get an infinite number of terms with the pi a. And as I go further and further out, I get more powers of pi a, and I get more powers of f. So this tells me, first of all, that this theory, by construction, is non-renormalizable, but that the thing that sets the scale of the theory, the thing that tells me the range of validity of my effective field theory, is this f. And if I look at this form, as I expand this out further, what I'm going to get as I go higher and higher is I'm going to get more powers of derivatives and more powers of pi's and more powers of 1 over f. So the upshot of all this is I now have an effective field theory that's valid for momenta well below this f scale. And we're going to come back in a second and figure out what the f is, but we'll see that it's on the order of lambda QCD. So yes?
So if you do take some of the higher order terms, we wouldn't get possibly equation of motion which is second order, would we? And with that, so I'm thinking of like in a classical term in terms of boundary value problem. Is that something that gets concerned?
Yeah, so we're going to treat this theory in the way we always treat quantum field theories, which is that, or almost always, which is that we're going to take the leading canonical terms and use that to figure out the free theory and treat everything else as a treat everything else as a perturbation. Now, the other thing is, in terms of boundary values for quantum field theory, the boundary value we typically always choose is just that the fields and the derivatives should go to 0 and infinity. So the higher derivative terms still respect that, and you don't get any funny business in that sense. Now, if you look at the full classical equation of motion, it will look a bit weird, but following what we usually do for perturbation in quantum field theory, we're always going to treat those higher order terms as perturbations that are in some sense small and perturb around the free theory that's well-defined. OK, now, in general, as I go further out in the expansion, I'm going to get more and more I'm going to get more and more terms. Those terms, we see, though, necessarily always come in with derivatives. If I don't put in a derivative, I just get sigma, dagma, sigma. I always need sigma, dagma, sigma to get something that's real. But without derivatives, I just get something that goes to 1 and is trivial. So this goes back to this shift symmetry. So the fact that we're writing the field in terms of an exponential of something in this funny exponential form, the motivation for this was to write down the field variables in terms of something that had the appearance of a transformation acting on the condensate. We see that we get this out. And going back over here, we get these derivative terms. And this is one thing we could write down in the Lagrangian. But in principle, we could also write down other stuff in the Lagrangian. So the other stuff we could write down in the Lagrangian starts to get a bit hairier. But let me give you an example of the kinds of terms we can get. So first of all, this already gives us an infinite number of terms. And you should think of the higher order terms as being suppressed relative to the leading term by powers of, in general, p over f. So the further I go out and apply to a process at an energy much lower than f, I'm going to get factors of that look like the energy of the momentum. And as long as I stick to low energy, these are small corrections. So this is the usual effective field theory paradigm. Okay, so for this first term, the form was just fixed by getting a canonical kinetic term, but we have other terms we can write down that are more complicated. So these so-called LP to the fourth, this thing is a so-called P square term. The next set of terms I can write down have this form, trace and then I can just think about, I can just put in stuff with fancier and fancier contraction structures. Oops. Oops. Sorry, I wrote this the wrong way. So what I do in general is write down all the possible terms I can in my Lagrangian. But and in general, there are an infinite number of them. That are consistent with the various symmetries and give me non-trivial pieces. The so-called p-square piece is a leading one, and I already get a tower of interactions. Here the coefficients are fixed. For these even higher order pieces, the so-called p to the fourth pieces, these objects are I have no idea what the L1, L2, L3 are, but I have to go off and compare data. So for example, I could look at scattering of various states and figure out what the L1, L2, L3 coefficients are. But in general, because I can't do an analytic matching, either have to use non-perturbative lattice QCD methods to fix these coefficients or use data. Okay. So now we have a reasonable effective field theory that realizes all the symmetries and describes 3 degrees of freedom. And I can have all kinds of interactions, but hopefully, if I stick to low energy, I only need to keep a few. Things don't get so bad. We want to connect these Nebel-Golson boson fields with stuff we see observationally. And in QCD, it turns out that the three things, or the three lightest fields that we know are connected to the strong interaction are the pions. We have a neutral and charged pions. These are a fair bit lighter than any other QCD states. And it's natural to try to associate those pions with these Nebel-Golson bosons. Now, under parity, you can show that the pi A's transform with odd parity. They're pseudoscalars. And this is also what you expect for Nebel-Golson bosons. And it turns out that the visible pions also are Nebel-Golson are also pseudoscalars. So this seems to work. One thing we'd like to check, though, is how to decompose the pi A's and how to identify them with the observable pions. And for that, we have to look at electric charge. So when I wrote the original QCD theory, I wrote down pure QCD. I didn't put in any photon interactions. But to include photon interactions, I could have put in a photon and added it to the covariant derivative, engaged everything, and put in a minus 1/4 f mu nu, f mu nu. We want, as far as putting the photon in, we would like to identify the generator of electromagnetic transformations. And if I look at the U and the V part, you can show that the generator acting on quarks can be identified with T3L plus T3R plus 1/6 times the identity, which I can think of as the generator for the U1V. So the way to see this is, suppose I look at, for example, UL and DL. So UL has T3L of 1/2, is going to have 1/6 of the U1V of 1/6, and this gives me the 2/3. For DL, I would have minus 1/2 plus 1/6 equals 1/3, and you do the same thing for the R pieces. So the upshot of this is that there is a subgroup of my original flavor symmetry group that corresponds to electromagnetism. And that is specifically the U1 electromagnetism means that I take e to the I it means that I transform in this two-component big QL, big QR language by this transformation, which is obviously a subgroup of the full SU2L cross SU2R cross U1. So as far as this U1 of electromagnetism goes, we identify this as our generators on the quarks, and we can transfer this over to figure out the transformations in our effective field theory by identifying this with a subgroup of the left-right flavor group and applying it to our pies. And doing this, and you'll get some more experience with this in the tutorial today, you can show that pi 0 can be identified with pi 3, and pi plus minus coincide with root 2 pi 1 plus or minus I pi 2. Sorry, this should be minus plus. So if I look for things that transform in a straightforward way under this subgroup of T3L, T3R, and U1, we see that we can identify neutral and charged pions with our original pi fields. So this is where the notation comes from. Note that pi plus minus is a complex field in the sense that pi 1 star is pi minus, which you see from the explicit form with pi 1 and pi 2 both real fields. Now, there are two things we have to fix up at this point. And the first thing we have to fix up is figure out what this F coupling is. And the other thing is the observed pions have masses on the order of 135 MeV, whereas in our effective field theory, everything's massless. So we have to address these two things. And to address these two things, we're going to take our effective field theory and match it to quark operators and include masses as well. OK, so as far as figuring out what the F is, what we do there is what we do here is match currents, conserve currents in the effective theory to conserve currents in the full theory. And what I mean by that is our effective field theory, our low energy theory, has the same set of symmetries as a full QCD theory. And corresponding to that, I can find another currents for the effective theory and for the full QCD theory. And there should be some identification between those in the sense that the matrix element of a current in the full theory should match onto the matrix element of the current in the effective theory. So we have conserved currents for J mu V, J mu L, J mu R, A, and so on and so forth. And you can find them in terms of quarks. You can find them in terms of of the sigma fields. And for example, this left-handed current looks like Q bar gamma mu PL TAQ in the usual sense. And we know that in the theory of quarks and so on, this is the object connects to the vector bosons. And we also know that there is a decay of the charged pion to some effective interaction Hamiltonian. And the effective interaction Hamiltonian, in this case, is going to be determined by the weak interaction. And in terms of the weak interaction, in terms of quarks, it turns out to just be g squared over 2mw squared u bar gamma mu pl d mu bar gamma mu pl nu mu. And this effective interaction is what you get from integrating out the W boson. So you integrate the W boson at, let's say, 80 MeV. This gives you this effective Fort-Fermion operator. And this Fort-Fermion operator is a subset on the quark side of this JL current that W couples to. Now, we take this, and this operator can also be identified with an operator in terms of sigma, which is specifically J mu 1 L plus J mu 2 L, which in terms of our effective theory, you can show that it turns out to be I over root 2 F del mu. Oh, sorry, I'm making a bit of a mess of this, but del mu pi minus. So what we've done is we have this effective coupling to the W from the weak interaction, and we can identify this with the thing that goes into this effective operator for that controls pion decay. And this is the muon neutrino part, so that's going to contract over here, and this interaction Hamiltonian is going to contract into the pion. And what we can do in our effective theory is identify the J mu L current in the quark theory with the J mu L current in the effective theory, and just apply it by applying Noether's theorem in the two theories. And the leading term in this, in an F expansion, looks like del mu pi minus. So I take this, I plug it in here, I contract up this part with this guy, and I contract up that part with that guy. And what I get is a value for this matrix element that I can use to get a rate for the decay rate of the pi minus. So pi minus goes to mu minus anti nu mu. And by taking this rate, matching up to this coefficient that we get from matching the weak interaction, and the fact that the hadronic part that I contract into the pi minus depends on f, this thing lets me extract this f, and it's called f sub pi, and it turns out to be numerically about 93 MeV from data. So this is nice. This is on the order of lambda QCD. And what I've done here, again, is matched up the symmetries in my effective theory with the symmetries in my full theory. In that the symmetries in the full theory, I can connect up to an effective coupling to the W in terms of quark operators. And this operator in terms of quarks matches on to some effective operator in the effective theory because it's a current. And I can match it on to the effective operator in the effective theory that turns out to be this, a leading order. I plug this into my interaction Hamiltonian, contract everything out, compute, find the rate, and extract a value for F, and I get my 93 MeV. So for my pion theory, I've done the first thing I want to do. I've taken my F, and I figured out what it has to be based on data. So it's a slightly circuitous route, but it's a circuitous route that depends on on matching to data. Now the second thing I want to do, and you will cover this, I think, in today's tutorial in more detail, and that is just mention how to put in masses. And this will just take a second. So I can include masses. by adding mass terms. As Q bar L and this mass matrix is just the diagonal FMU MD. And what I mean by this is that if I take this in my two component notation and expand it out, what I just get is this piece gives me a U bar L MU UR plus D bar L MD DR plus the Hermitian conjugate. And in this theory, if I look at the transformation law, this term isn't invariant under the flavor group. Under the flavor group, this thing goes to Q bar L, L dagger, M, R, Q R. Now, I can preserve flavor symmetry if I pretend that the M transforms as well. And if I pretend that M transforms in this way, I will preserve the flavor symmetry. And in this sense, because this pretend transformation law keeps a symmetry, I should be able to write down terms involving this mass matrix M in the effective field theory and still maintain the full symmetry by assuming that the M also transforms, or at least pretending that it transforms. It doesn't actually transform. This is an explicit breaking of the flavor symmetry. But if I pretend that it transforms in this way and keep track of this, I'll be able to keep track of the violation of the flavor group. And it turns out that this lets me write my effective Lagrangian, a term that looks like as follows. Trace M sigma. Actually, the way I've written it down, it should be M dagger sigma. Because if I look at how M transforms in the same way as sigma. So this thing transforms. This is invariant if I also pretend that M transforms. And if I take this and I expand it out, what you find, so this is the coefficient I put in to get the dimensions right. And we don't know what it is, but we expect that it should be roughly lambda QCD cubed on general grounds. If I put this in and plug it in, what you'll show today, I think in either the homework or the tutorial, is that this thing gives a mass term for the pion. When you expand out the sigma to second order, I get a mass term squared for the pion that looks like m pi squared f pi squared is equal to lambda cubed times m up plus m down. So this is nice. This tells us that if we include the quark masses, we see that we explicitly break the symmetry group. Our Nambu-Goldstone bosons are no longer exactly Nambu-Goldstone bosons. They're only approximate Nambu-Goldstone bosons, or sometimes we say pseudo Nambu-Goldstone bosons, or PNGB. And they have masses that are relatively smaller than lambda QCD. And these masses turn out to come out to be about 135 GeV. Sorry, MeV. So we're also able to see within this formulation that we get charged and neutral pions. And at this level, both the charged and neutral pions get equal masses set by this relation. And if you like, this relation is equivalent to fixing the lambda tilde. OK, so I'm going to wrap it up here. Just in passing, though, I want to mention that what we're going to do next is take this QCD structure and show that if you had the standard model without a Higgs, well, if you don't have a Higgs, first of all, you wouldn't have masses. So let's ignore the masses for now. But the other thing you would get out of this condensate structure is that our SE2 left here is identical in structure, at least in the global limit, to SE2 left weak transformations. And we see that part of the SE2 left weak transformation is spontaneously broken by the quark condensate. So what we see, what we're going to see is that these QCD dynamics, this quark condensate, actually breaks electric symmetry in the absence of a Higgs. So there's actually some contribution to electric symmetry breaking in the standard model from QCD, from this quark condensate picture. And we're essentially going to take this picture of QCD breaking electric symmetry breaking and scale it up to a new gauge group and call it Technicolor. Yes?
So where did the gluons go? We just ignored them?
Yeah, so gluons, so the gluons are also going to feel the strong dynamics, and we also expect them to clump together to make stuff with masses on the order of lambda QCD. So the expectation is that there should be some glue ball states. Because the glue ball states, we also expect to have masses close to or on the order of lambda QCD. So we're only focusing on the stuff that, based on the symmetries, is guaranteed to be light. Now, in general, there will be other excitations, but these are more complicated. Okay, so I've gone over, so I better wrap up, but. Sorry, go ahead.